Welcome, everyone, to the fifth episode of the Baptizing Philosophy podcast. Today, I'm here with Eric Orwal from the Erval channel and also from the Understanding Plato channel. That's sort of a newer project he's doing. From what I've heard from previous videos I've watched, your kind of YouTube mission is to give Plato to the masses, kind of to educate people about Plato and stuff, which is cool because I don't know if there's any other channels that I've come across which has really helped me with the details and like the nitty gritty in terms of Platonic philosophy, because it can get pretty complex and you have to know how to read him because he's a unique writer, especially coming from a modern perspective. So I guess my first question would just be, how did you end up becoming a Platonist, and why did you become a Platonist? Like, what exactly about Platonism did you find to be interesting and worth pursuing?
Right. Like a lot of people, I started by thinking about the problem of universals and also the ontological status of mathematical objects. Yeah. Max Tegmark was actually influential on me starting to think seriously about mathematical Platonism. He makes a lot of good arguments. Roger Penrose also makes good arguments. Basically, unless mathematicals have some kind of independent existence, it's very difficult to make a case for objectivity in math. And yet, clearly, math is like phenomenally successful in engineering applications. It works in the world. Like, there's clearly a reality to it. So I was a Platonist in a loose sense, like I guess a lowercase p Platonist for years when I was first kind of getting into philosophy. And I read Plato early on, you know, just kind of snippets from various dialogues. I had like a Penguin Classics, you know, compilation softcover book that I went through, and I always enjoyed it. But I didn't really understand that there was a much more serious philosophical system kind of in the background there. So, you know, I started looking more at more modern philosophy. You know, I got interested in Arthur Schopenhauer. I liked Chris Langan's philosophy. And then eventually I decided I would go back. This was around 2015, actually. I would go back and just read all of Plato's dialogues and then go on. My plan was to like read all of Plato and Aristotle. I still have not read all of Aristotle. If anyone has tried to like read through his Organon, it's miserable. It's just, he's such a dense and unclear writer, like in objective terms. And I was reading, so this is a digression, but I was reading like a modern commentary on his Prior Analytics, and he does contradict himself. He's not like a totally logical writer himself, so he has problems, and that's part of what leads to people not being able to read him. But in any case, we're still working through Aristotle in my reading groups. But reading through all of the dialogues, I started to kind of understand the nature of the philosophical system there. But even then, I still kind of like partly entered into it, and I identified as a Platonist, you know, still, but in a loose sense. And I still kind of had my own philosophical views first and foremost, right, in my mind. And then even later, around 2021, I started these reading groups. We had an initial kind of version of this that didn't use the IM Blakeian curriculum. So it was kind of like a beta version of what I'm now doing. And I guess I was just old enough to start to really understand it, had enough experience to start to really understand it. And that's when I started thinking, like, we really have not progressed past Platonism at all. Like, he still has the best solutions for most of the major problems in philosophy. Like, there was this article by J.K. Swindler, who's a contemporary analytical philosopher, and he's looking at the problem of like negative existential reference. So how it's possible to say things about things that don't exist, you know, because those statements have true properties about them, and yet the referent of the proposition in question doesn't exist. So how does that
work? Like unicorns have horns, like, exactly. For example. Okay.
Right. Yeah. And like Bertrand Russell and Willard Quine also developed a solution that basically tried to render those propositions as utterly meaningless. J.K. Swindler points out in this article that like that doesn't work for various technical reasons, and he ultimately sides with a Platonic account, which says that there isn't such a thing as like absolute non-existence. The things that we say don't exist are simply different from the existence that we have access to, in that what we have access to is actual, and those non-existent beings are possible. But that does entail like a realm of possible beings, just like it entails a realm of mathematicals. You know, Platonism has a very large ontology. And while that can seem unparsimonious, it ends up providing really convenient and neat solutions for a lot of philosophical problems.
Cool. So in that last example you brought up, what from a Platonist perspective would be the defining difference between something that only has possible existence and something that has actual existence? Does it have something to do with matter? Because I know that I've talked to some Platonists, and basically they see matter as the I don't even know what the term, like, I guess principle of differentiation and individuation. And I guess in some way that would be linked with actuality, but how would you see that?
Yeah, I think that's fair. The way that Plotinus characterizes matter in the second Aeneid, fourth tractate, sensible matter is this kind of principle of individuation, in that what things here, what bodies have in common are their formal properties. And what distinguishes them is like the matter that those formal properties are inhabiting at any given point in time. And I think that's a pretty good concept. Matter then in the sensible realm represents this kind of pure potential for actuality. What is actual is always what's formal. Ultimately leads to a kind of privatio reality view of matter itself, where matter doesn't have like a pure existence in the sense that there's no such thing as like just matter completely by itself. However, there is a sensible, rather intelligible matter that is like the paradigm in the image of which the sensible matter is formed. So there is such a thing as an archetype of matter in a sense, and that's at the very kind of highest levels of the ontological hierarchy with the indefinite dyad, which is a Pythagorean concept, very ancient concept metaphysically, that you kind of have the one, right, of course, and then immediately after that, you have the monad, principle of limitation, and the indefinite dyad, principle of kind of energy and it manifests as potential here as well, but that indefinite dyad is equated with the kind of intelligible matter or the archetype of matter. And there already you do kind of have this potential actual difference, right? Like the indefinite dyad provides a kind of substrate for the formal principles in the forms themselves, like the realm of forms. Just like, you know, sensible matter acts as a substrate for the kind of instantiated formal properties in the world of generation. So as far as like the, I'm sorry, can you repeat like the original question about potentials precisely?
The question was about matter, and then I guess, because I was trying to, because you basically said that you mentioned someone like Quine and Russell, I think, who had the issue of they were thinking about potential and how there's a sense in which there's things like a unicorn that doesn't have actual existence but has potential existence.
No, so that's the Platonist solution. Russell and Quine were arguing that the statement is meaningless. that there isn't a referent. Like,
gotcha.
Yeah. Okay. So the Platonist solution requires this actual potential dichotomy. So there's different levels of the actual and the potential. In a certain sense, the potential is in the realm of forms. Like the realm of forms pure act in that sense. However, it is, of course, eternal. And so it's not moving from one state to another state in the way that potential works here. There, like the substrate principle, the indefinite dyad as that intelligible matter, material substrate for the forms, is a kind of potential, but obviously of a very different sort than sensible potential realities. And in the world of generation, you'll need a soul to measure that time in order to have the distinction between like what we typically think of as actuality and potentiality. So that, like, the mundane sense of actual and potential, that originates with soul. So with the world soul is like the principal soul, and then all other souls kind of beneath that level.
Okay, yeah, thank you. So for you're kind of presenting this ontology where there's like a hierarchy of different, like, even a, and there's hierarchies, even seems like there's hierarchies within those hierarchies. But I guess the general question about that, coming from a Christian perspective, and I think this is sort of like a classic Christian critique of Platonism, and it has to do with the way in which these different levels of being interact or commune with, to use Christian language, and how does, like, for example, I guess, I mean, the fundamental question would be, how do we get from the monad to multiplicity? Like, what exactly, what occurs in order for the monad to, in a certain sense, give rise to multiplicity? And because from a Christian perspective, the unity and multiplicity are equally ultimate in the Trinity. So we already have a principle of multiplicity in the absolute. But it seems like from a Platonist perspective, the absolute cannot contain multiplicity. So where exactly, where does multiplicity arise from?
Right. Well, in the one itself, you don't have a pure simplicity in cataphatic terms. We can't directly predicate simplicity of the one, even though it's called the one. It's called the one in the sense that that's like the intelligible concept that we can grasp that kind of captures the nature of it the most. Of course, it's the one and the good. So there too, there is a kind of multiple aspect quality that this highest thing has. Damascius, a late Neoplatonist, even says that like there is a unity and a multiplicity in the one. So this isn't, you know, foreign to Platonic language. But as far as solving the problem of the one and the many, Proclus basically makes the argument that in order for something to be as good as possible, it can't simply be self-perfect, but it has to go beyond that and perfect other things. And so the highest of all beings, if it's not going to be prolific, won't be like the greatest conceivable being. It won't be as good as it could otherwise be. So to be the best that it can be, the one, the principle of all things, has to generate. And it generates first that which is highest and noblest, and doesn't directly create all the levels of beings beyond that. Instead, it creates like the monad, indefinite dyad, is its direct images, the one capturing the oneness of it, the other capturing the power of it, right? Then beyond that, you have the henads, which are different aspects of unity. Of course, this is all within the first hypostasis. So there's three main levels of being. The hypostases are levels of being, essentially. The first hypostasis, you have the one, monad, indefinite dyad, and then the henads, which Iamblichus probably introduced. Although I would argue that it is there in Plato, even the metaphor of the cave, I think there is a reference indirectly to the idea of the henads, but that would be a sidetrack, so let's not. But the henads are aspects of unity that sort of correspond to each of the individual forms. Sort of like the case of the form. You know, that oneness that a particular thing has in a unique way. So the one generates all of that more or less directly, and then the top of the next level of being will kind of be being, strictly speaking, ousia itself, the principle of essence. Everything in the first hypostasis is super essential in that what an essence is like an eternal nature that is defined, that like characterizes some particular thing. Things in the first hypostasis are beyond essential predication. They're beyond that intelligible principle. They have unity and they have goodness, but they're not, they're supra intelligible beings. So then you have ousia and this new class of beings, and you have kind of a new act of creation at each level. Like a thing perfects itself and then goes on to begin perfecting other things and generating other things. I mean, that even applies in the world of generation itself.
Okay, yeah, I didn't know any of that, but I think that's yeah, that helps to clarify a lot because there are a lot of overlaps here with Christianity. But I would say that just off the top of my head, what seems to be the main difference, and I'm kind of just wondering what your general take is on the Trinity, because I think that would be the difference that we agree that there's a sense in which to be perfect, you cannot be perfect in just alone. Like you can't be that's not the fullness of perfection, because perfection involves a sharing, like a love, a almost like a dynamic reality. And for us, God himself as Trinity is this perfect unity and multiplicity. He in himself, the Father generates the Son and inspires the Spirit, and then there's this communion of love. So already in God himself, there is this self-giving. There is this unity of identity and difference, because there is a unity, there is an identity in the difference. There the three persons of the Trinity are fully mutually interior to one another. So I would just wonder, like what would be your reason for rejecting this understanding of the absolute? Like this is kind of the equivalent of the one for us, even though we would say following Pseudo Dionysius and others that the essence of God, what God is incomprehensible, but who God is, this has been revealed to us as Trinity. So just to wrap my point up, the you when you're talking about how the one gives generates, for lack of a more precise term, generates multiplicity below it, it's almost like the one isn't complete in itself, so it requires something. There's almost like a necessity of creation problem here that we don't, like traditionally we haven't fallen into that, because God is already perfect in his Trinitarian communion. He already meets the criteria of inner perfection in and through his sacrificial perfection, which you were talking about. So that already occurs in God, instead of it having the one and then the one having to generate lower levels of being. So what's your general take on the Trinity, and why like I know you call yourself a Christian, but you're not a Trinitarian, so you actually wouldn't meet the criteria of a Christian according to the Orthodox Church, but you clearly see something in Christ, and there definitely are overlaps. Like I've talked with other Platonists, and they kind of gave a different picture of than what you were talking about. Like I've never heard about this perfection needing to go beyond itself to perfect others. So yeah. What's your view on the Trinity?
Right. Well, I mean, the three persons of the Trinity, the Greek language there is hypostasis.
Hypostasis, yeah.
So many people in late antiquity associated the three hypostases that Plotinus talks about with the three persons of the Trinity. And there's a school of thought that that is the original sense of the term hypostasis in the Christian tradition, and that it became more of a personalistic concept later. I don't know the historical veracity of that for
I
sure,
don't think so.
but
Yeah, I don't think so, because of the Cappadocian fathers, who kind of they're the ones who really developed this, and they're fourth century. So I think Christians have been personalists for for since the beginning. Personally.
Why do they use the term hypostasis?
Actually, I would, if you want to look into this, you can find a PDF of John Zezulis's book Being as Communion online. The first chapter, he talks about the development of the term, both the term prosopon, which is person or mask in Greek theater, and then how hypostasis came around. And his whole argument is that before the Cappadocian fathers, especially, but I mean the Christians in particular, or Christians in general, the notion of person never had, like, there never was this absolute value to the person, like for like prosopon meant mask in Greek, so there was like this idea right. that there was like there wasn't like an absolute value, there's something like fake about it, something inauthentic, but
yeah so, like for the mystery religions, probably personhood was something to be overcome,
right?
You know,
and do you take that position
in you the do, sense right? I mean, there are different senses of personhood. So I guess to answer that, I'd have to get at why did they start using the term hypostasis, and what is the difference between the original, mask concept of personhood and this other concept? Because I don't know if that's there in the Greek literature otherwise, using hypostasis to mean this term person. So... if you could just explain that historically, why did they start using hypostasis, and what's the definitional change there that happened?
Well, I think hypostasis wasn't used to refer to mask. I'm pretty sure. No. Hypostasis right, kind of meant hypostasis, and from my understanding, hypostasis and ousia were basically used synonymously. I've heard that similar, right? So it wasn't. I don't think it was really until the Nicene Council where there was that like the distinction between ousia and hypostasis, and hypostasis referred to person. And I think I'm not exactly sure, like I'm not that well read on the history of it, but I'm not exactly sure why they ended up using the term hypostasis and defining it the way they did.
It's
but
just weird because it's exactly in that time period they started using this term, when it was a technical term within Platonism. Also, a lot of the Christians during that time were Platonists, like bishops.
Yeah.
Studied Neoplatonism. Yeah. And even like one of them, I forgot the name, I was just looking into this guy, he like said, okay, I'll be a bishop in the church, but I still believe in the eternity of the world, the created world, that is, and various other like Neoplatonic doctrines. So the fact that the traditions were so tightly enmeshed, and then they use this Neoplatonic technical term in a Neoplatonic it's not quite the Neoplatonic sense, it's the history there, I think, is very ambiguous. Yeah. And in any case, if there was an influence from Neoplatonism onto Christianity regarding the notion of the three hypostases, the three persons, then it would basically mean that the one has a counterpart in the intelligible, that is ousia, being itself, the principle, the kind of form of forms within the realm of forms. Sometimes the one is called like the form of forms. There's a lack of like clarity in the technical language here because we're speaking English and not Greek.
Yeah.
But basically the correspondence is the one would be like the role of the father, more or less. The principal form in the realm of forms would be like the logos, would be like the son.
Yeah.
And then the world soul would be like the Holy Spirit. And it doesn't line up perfectly because the world soul is psuche and spirit is pneuma. And there's like, that's a marked difference in the New Testament, you know, to kind of let go of the psuche and embrace the pneuma, more or less. There's also the pneuma within Platonism as well. And so there would, within like the pneumatic realm, there would be a principal member. This is the notion of the Sarai, divine series, where from the one, there's a row kind of moving straight down through the hierarchies that is the most principally divine, right? The truest embodiment of the one at each level. That same thing would apply to the other aspects of unity as well. Though, so you would have not just Father, Son, to use the Christian language, and Spirit in that column, but you would have like the aspect of unity that is that of the guardian like the Athena imagery, you know, that which guards and unites in that sense. And then you would have the corresponding notion of guardianship in the realm of forms, and a corresponding like guardian soul that actually acts in the world to affect this at its own level. So I think the hypostases and the notion of the divine Sarai map fairly well onto the Christian notion of the Trinity, because like the Godhead is not restricted to the first hypostasis in a certain sense, because we do identify the manifestations of a particular divine series here with its ultimate source. Like Proclus talks about in the myths, in the Greek myths, when we have an apparition of Zeus, Zeus comes here and does something. It's not the henatic Zeus, like the principal Zeus that actually manifests in the world and does things. It's more like a daimonical apparition or a spirit that itself is in that divine series. So what we make contact with, I mean, it's also sort of similar to the essence energy distinction. You're not making contact with the essence of Zeus for Proclus. It's a generated being, which is distinct from the, you know, the energies of God are not generated, of course, in Orthodoxy. And maybe this term, again, it's an English technical term that might not map perfectly onto what Proclus would have meant, but in any case, it is something in the series of that henatic Zeus that we actually make contact with. Right. So I have no problem with the Trinitarian language. I mean, I think of the Father basically in the image of the One, the Son as that kind of presiding principle of order of the cosmos, not restricted to the cosmos, you know, transcending, but also indwelling in the cosmos. And then the Holy Spirit, I mean, it does make sense to me that there would be this, like, because there are different spiritual motions, of course, and one is going to be in that principal divine series that, like, deserves the most honor, respect, worship, and should be followed, right? So I you know, I have no problem with the Trinitarian. The problem is, for me, that, like, the technical Orthodox or Catholic language around the Trinity is like non-philosophical, and so ultimately, like, it's just a bunch of, to my mind, to my perspective, it's just a bunch of words. Because the Catholic Church will, like, say, you know, you have to believe this, this, and this about the Trinity, these particular predicates, but like, you can't define them. You're saying it's beyond human reason. So, like, what exactly am I even believing? So I don't know. I don't know whether, you know, I could be called a Trinitarian fairly or not. Yeah. But that's kind of, yeah. Well, and then the personhood notion, I'm still interested in, like, exactly what's meant by hypostasis in the Orthodox Church and Catholicism for that matter.
Right. Well, for us, there is a certain sense in which you can't define a person in intellectual terms. And I think this has to do with this kind of has to do with our rejection of, certain, I would say, Platonist influence notions of the beatific vision, and by us I mean the Orthodox, because there's a certain sense in which it transcends unity with God, transcends the intellect, precisely because he's a person. So what you know of God is him as a person. So it's like a personal encounter between us and God, and for us there's a certain irreducibility of a personal encounter, in the same way there's an irreducibility of the person to anything that you could point out. Like for example, in your debate with Jay a few years back, you were talking about how you were influenced a lot by Tegmark, and you were an information reductionist. I don't know if you still are, but then Jay asks you, well, we're persons and we're talking to each other, so what would how would you fit in the person within an information theory of reality? And I mean, I would have the same question, because for me, the problem with the notion of personhood and why it's difficult is, I think there, you can't describe it, because you can't circumscribe what a person is. You can't have a person is absolute image of God, eternal. We're But so what you can't do is define and circumscribe a person, but what you can do is experience the person through a personal relationship. So
actually, I do have an answer to that now. So
okay, sure.
So basically, I'm an information reductionalist in physics, but physics is not the ultimate reality. That's in the world of generation.
Right.
So if hypostasis is taken to be that substrate of existence, then for things here, the soul, like the hyparxis or summit of the soul, is in that hypostasis of soul. So if that's the sense of personality transcending information, I have no problem with that. You know, the principle of the soul, what gives the soul its unity, is beyond information. But that's because soul is beyond the generated world. You know, so the physical world may reduce to information, but that doesn't mean that levels beyond physics don't actually come down and influence things here.
Sure. And so where would you fit the person? Like, because for us, like me as a, like, to use kind of, I guess, psychological language, like me as an ego, like a person, a center of consciousness, in Christianity, I will continue to exist eternally. Like I was created, and then because God is perfect in himself, and for us, God is like, and I, you say this too about the one, like God is beyond eternity. God is super essential, right? So eternity, eternity for us is, well, time for us is, and I remember Jay, like in your debate, he was like, oh, time, the philosophy, theology of time is really difficult in Orthodoxy. And actually it is kind of hard to explain to people who aren't familiar with it, but, God is in eternity. He created us into time. Like the heavens were created perfect. And then earth, the world was formless and void, and the purpose, of God's plan for creation is to unite the heavens with the earth. And then that is that is the eschaton. That's us entering into eternity. And eternity is a personal relationship with God, a direct experience with God, because time for us is the interval of waiting between acts of love. So, and by love, we just mean like procession and reversion towards, like movement towards the other, and the others return back. God is eternal because the Father, Son, there's no distance in the relationship of love between the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. They're perfectly mutually interior. So we're meant to become, by grace, deified, which is to say we enter into the Trinitarian communion, not by nature, but by grace, and we are deified. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, us as persons will remain in eternity. We will enter into this communion, and we will remain eyes, like concrete, distinct, individual persons, but will be united fully with God and with others in the sense of full mutual interiority, where there's essentially this perfect no more distance, a perfect unity between people while remaining distinct. So this is like a classic, like unity and distinction, unity and distinction idea that we affirm. So where for you is, where does the person begin? Like, because like you said, the person can't be reduced to information, but where exactly does it begin? And I guess like my another question would be like, the one can't be personal. Like, I guess you can't believe in a God with a face, can you? Like, you can't believe in a God who has a personality and is a person in the sense that we could talk to, like we could pray, like we can pray to God who is the one for us. But I don't know if you would be praying to the one, if that even makes sense, since I don't think the person, the notion of person, would apply at that level of reality.
Yeah, I think, again, we're dealing with this ambiguity about the concept of the hypostasis. The terms that you use to describe personality, like an ego or like a center of consciousness, in Carl Jung's sense, he would define that as the self, and the persona he would use more in that sense of the mask, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, as you're describing it, it seems like you're talking about the kind of self with the capital S, exactly as Carl Jung uses it. So, I mean, if that's the case, you know, ultimately I do tend still towards a kind of Advaita Vedanta perspective here, kind of at the highest level, but there's some subtlety here, because I do think there's an eternal existence of souls, and souls are distinct. So I don't think that the soul blends into the one and dissipates. But at the same time, the hyparxis of the soul goes, so before I said it was kind of rooted in the hypostasis of soul, that's oversimplifying it. Ultimately, like the extreme summit of the soul reaches into the realm of intellect, nous. That's why we have intellects, right? Because that the soul is suspended from the realm of forms, ultimately. And obviously those forms, like if you keep zooming in to the summit of the soul and what is most, like what is closest to the center of our being and identity, first we go, well, we're, the soul is us, sort of, basically. And then like within us, the we are grounded in intelligible principles, our intellect, which is the summit of our own being as our soul. But then within that, like you keep going to the summit of intellect, and eventually you get back, you have to get back to the one, which grants the unity for all things. Mm-hmm. And so what makes the intellect in us one? What gives it reality fundamentally? It is the one. And yet, qua its our participation in it as our particular soul, we are in kind of a particular henatic series. We are making contact with a particular aspect of unity. But even there, still, there is this kind of, if you go beyond that, still, everything terminates back in the one. But it's problematic to talk about the one in relational terms, insofar as the one, like at its summit, is kind of transcendent of relationship with, as like via without. I don't know how to put this exactly, but the one, like you can't say that there's, here's the one and here's all other things, right? And there are these fixed indefinite relationships that persist for all time, because then the one is not absolute. The one is not like ultimate in some sense, because its definition of like what it is and where it is contextual. It has to do with where all these other beings are that it relates to. From like the one's perspective, there isn't anything but it. And yet from our perspective, there is this distinction between like the summit of our being as one transcendent in a, and in a sense other than us, insofar as we're in that relation with it. But like for the one, it's sort of like for God, all things are good type deal. Like for the one, there is only what's already within it. And there is this principle in Platonism, and it, you know, made explicit by Proclus, that there's causal containment, where everything that's real in lower levels is there seminally and causally in the higher level. So the one contains the multiplicity of all real beings in some sense. Mm-hmm. And so then contains like us individually, which does look like this mutual communion. I mean, as far as I can tell, Orthodox theology was derived from Neoplatonism. I mean, that's kind of how it looks to me. And I do see these similarities now as I've learned more about Neoplatonism and more about Orthodoxy since that encounter with Jay. But yeah, so I mean, did that kind of answer?
Yeah, no.
I want to qualify one more thing.
Sure.
So this is not explicit in Neoplatonism or in Plato himself. There are only hints at the idea. But the question is whether, like in our cycle of reincarnation, which Platonists do believe in, whether we are kind of consigned to always identify with our particular soul, or in some sense, if we can transcend time as ourself, as our center of identification, like what are we fundamentally identifying with? Is it possible to kind of transcend out of the realm of soul through intellect all the way back to the one? Can we return to the one fully? This kind of henosis idea where we would no longer be, like I wouldn't be any more Eric than you are Trey. Like at that point, we would, okay. I would, if full-on henosis took place, it would be kind of all of these identities would be brought into a total unity. Although, again, not a cataphatically simple thing, but unity as far as, you know, what the excellences that we see in unified things here, that to like the asymptotic extension of the concept beyond our, you know, ability to actually, you know, make it intellectually clear.
Right.
So, but anyway, but that's really not clear. And Proclus even seems to indicate that like you are kind of fatalistically consigned always to cycle in this particular soul. And I would make sense of that by saying like the existence of the soul as one thing in reality, like that will cycle forever, no matter what. But like, is that really the self? Is that who you really are? In the first Alcibiades, Plato uses some language in the voice of Socrates that's a little ambiguous, but he basically like distinguishes between ourselves as the soul, and he hints beyond that and says like, are we even the soul, or are we the itself, or something along that lines, reminiscent of like I am that I am, you know? So that's not clear whether they're, you know, Neoplatonists could accept the full-on henosis, like absolute unity with the one, as far as that's conceivable, or if more of a theosis similar to the Orthodox concept is truer. Again, I still lean towards the Advaita Vedanta henosis concept.
Right. I mean, the last thing I'll say about that, like I know, like if I were to ask you to describe it in cataphatic terms, like as you were saying, like it's not really, really possible. But like to me, it seems like both of these are distinct from theosis, because with what you were talking about, the position you lean to, it seems like there has to be some sort of sacrifice of your own personal distinctiveness, while for theosis you remain distinct while God becomes fully, like he indwells in you, like the incarnation idea, the God indwells in on the earth, he tabernacles among us,
right.
He perfectly unites himself to the world,
but you lose all your negative qualities, right?
Right. Yes. You lose all the consequences of sin, right? Like you lose your fallen, you lose the incompletion. We are born into the world and time. We enter into eternity. But that, like for us, individuality is not the product of the fall, nor is it something that's going to be dispensed with. We were made like male and female. And only then, actually, if you read the Bible, typically like I know Augustine and others identified the image of God with the possession of rationality, which I don't think is wrong necessarily, but from the biblical perspective, image of God is referred to mankind as a whole after Eve is already made. So the image of God is the human family as a unity in distinction, as male and female, and also with the implication of children, because God says, be fruitful and multiply. So like for us, there is no loss of your individuality, like you're
right.
Because that would kind of, from my perspective, that would kind of negate theosis as a whole, because you're not there to experience your deification. And then with the other one you were talking about, which you were saying, and I think you're right, it's closer to theosis, but it seems like because it cannot be a unity with the absolute, like it kind of has to remain within a lower order of being. So that wouldn't be, how could that be perfection then? And I know you lean more towards the other idea, but it with the other one, it seems like I know, like you were saying that souls are eternal and stuff, but yeah, let's get more into that.
Here's a problem I see with this teleologically. Because I do think, given the kind of technical language that I was talking about around causal containment, the one already has all of the good attributes that I have. Everything that's good in me is there in the one. So if that's my individuality, then I don't lose it. But there isn't an exclusive identification with it, as compared to, like I said, I'm no more me than I am you at that point. I would also have all of your good qualities. So like teleologically, to accept that individuality entails like a kind of exclusive identification with this particular set of goods, then it seems then that we can't ever fulfill as much good as is possible, and God would therefore like assign to us an imperfect state of being in eternity. instead of perfecting absolutely, and instead of just identification with a particular set of good properties, instead you would identify with the whole, not losing that identity that you are, because it's causally contained in the one.
Then
you go beyond theosis as defined in orthodoxy, I would think.
Well, I mean, when you're talking about, I wouldn't accept that qualities, like you're talking about individuality and qualities, like I would take a more, just a more personalist view of what individuality is. Like, I don't think we are reducible to our qualities. I think, St. Gregory of Nyssa, one of the early fourth century Cappadocians, he talks about how there's an essence energy distinction within humans as well. There is there is us qua us, right, as we are, and then there is our qualities and or our energies, our activities. So I don't think we can reduce the person to qualities. So in terms of like just the way I would understand theosis, you have multiple absolute eyes. Like Saint Augustine has this famous quote where he says, God loves every person as if they were the only persons he created. And I think this gets to the idea that every single person is an absolute eternal being created to be eternal. Their individuality is good and meant to be preserved into eternity. And the way there is the unity is that instead of having this distance between minds now, like there's just a distance between people. And then within that space, because of our lack of communion, there is that space for lying, for rebelling, for self-will and all this stuff. That's the fallen world. And then theosis is becoming united together, everyone united together in Christ, in the Logos. So everyone maintains their individual eyes, even though I think there would be like a sharing of qualities, of properties. Like energies is right. Where communion takes place at an energetic level. And then it's through my activities, like it's through me talking and stuff that you know me right now and you're experiencing me. And that would be my energies. But then I still remain a distinct person. And then you just take this to its fullest conclusion where you're fully experiencing me. I'm fully experiencing you. Yet we remain distinct eyes, like distinct right. individualities.
Quality wasn't the best term to use. Property would be closer to what I was getting at, because there has to be a term that captures like attributes of essence, even if we're not talking about qualities, like what distinguishes one essence from another, whatever those distinguishing things are. That's kind of what I was getting at, instead of sure. quality, you know, strictly speaking.
Sure.
But I think the point still holds though, that teleologically, if it's good to be the essence that you are, and it's good to be for another person to be the essence that they are, I mean, seemingly in a kind of simplistic logic, it would be better to have both essential natures together instead of only being one to the exclusion of the other.
Right. But for us, I'm not exactly sure how you're using essence here, but for us, there's one essence. Like humans share one essence, and then what distinguishes us is our person. So, personhood. Oh, okay.
So wait, that's confusing then. So, individual human beings don't have individual essences at all. Then in Orthodoxy,
because we are particular. Like hypostasis in the language of especially Saint Maximus the Confessor, who I think you'd love if you haven't read him. He says that the hypostasis enhypostasizes, so particularizes, instantiates an essence, and there is no, for us, like we're not Platonists, like we're almost closer to Aristotle in the sense, and in the sense that for us, there is no essence without hypostasis. There is no essence prior to or before the determinate manifestation of the essence in a particular thing, in a hypostasis.
Well, then that doesn't seem to make sense, because before creation, God already had the logi
aren't our essence. Logi is not essence for us.
Okay, but God in his divine knowledge already contained all of the essences he was going to generate, right? Like, yeah. It's not like he added them when he actually created, as if it was another point in time. I guess, okay. So the rank order of hypostasis, usia, and how self-substantial these are is pretty confusing as you're describing it, because hypostases, persons, are created and so aren't self-substantial. And the usia, too, is, well, it must be created. And yet, like, in Plato, the language of usia would indicate an eternal form.
Right.
And I would, you know, equate, like, those forms as knowledge in the mind of God. And even right. Aristotle would have all of the usias as thoughts in the mind of God, and there's no distinction there. I think people, like, really misunderstand hylomorphism, and I don't think Aristotle held that forms don't exist prior to particular instantiation of things. But anyway, so yeah, I mean, I'm still not clear on how these concepts rank and why, and where's the logic for that. But, like, going back to the teleological issue, the point is, whatever I exclusively am in the, you know, blessed condition in after salvation is completed, you know, in theosis, what I exclusively am, I can understand there's a communication with all the other things in terms of energy, but my essence then is still kind of like mine only, and I don't have the essences of other things. It would seem that if the essences of other things are good for them, then the sum total of all of these essences together would have to be better than any one of them in isolation. So you remain isolated in some sense. And I wonder, what's the teleological justification for that? Not, I mean, I am kind of questioning the motives of God according to orthodoxy here, but why does God, like, aim for a salvation for us in which we remain separate at the essential level, from all other souls?
Well,
I forgot essence is shared in humanity, so I'm still confused.
We're different as persons, right? So I mean, like, we remain individualized, and I think the reason why is because God created us as God is personal, and He is complete in Himself. Because I agree 100% with you that true perfection involves a perfecting of others. So it involves, like the Eucharist, there's a notion of, like, a gift giving, right? So, like, God gives Himself to us, we give Him back to God. And this is all based on the Trinity, where there is, like, an eternal gift giving, where the Father gives Himself to the Son, and then He sees Himself in the Son through the Spirit, and the Spirit, the Son gives Himself back through the Spirit to Him. And then through this, this doesn't occur in time, obviously, this is logical, but they're always already united perfectly in one another. So there's this tri-personal communion. So being perfect in Himself, containing everything, all essences, all the logi, and the logi are not our essences, because human nature, like, human essence was created.
Right.
Logi are eternal, and logi are the patterns and the divine archetypes that, like, the blueprints that, so there's a blueprint and a notion of the, of human nature in the mind of God. And, that's the logi. And the logi are both distinct from creation and distinct from the essence of God, like who God is. So the logi are basically within the same, like, some people identify them absolutely with the divine energies. Some people want to say the divine energies are more so like God interacting with creation, but, like, the you know, in Palamite theology, at least, the energies are eternal. Like, the energies are Maximus talks about the rays or the glory surrounding the essence that eternally manifests from the essence, shines forth like the rays of the sun.
Wonder if that term is Sarai, by the way, just for the Neoplatonic orthodox history.
I wouldn't doubt it. So Yeah, so basically our goal at God as a person created something genuinely other than himself. Because he's complete in himself, he is able to create, and this is our doctrine of kenosis or self-limitation, where there is a real parallel between God's creation and Christ's sacrifice on the cross. And Maximus makes a link between Christ's sacrifice and creation, because God, as complete in himself, has the ability to self-limit and posit something, create out of nothing, ex nihilo, something genuinely other than him. And as genuinely, this genuinely other being is his image, right? So a person, and as a person, we are meant to be united with God by grace, like through his activities, through his love, the grace that he pours out. We are meant to synergize our wills with the will of God that he reveals through his grace and enter into eternity. And eternity is precisely defined as a personal communion with God. So the reason why it's teleologically, it would be justified that we remain distinct persons and aren't reduced to just something higher to get, is because if that were to occur, we would lose our individuality. We would lose our personhood.
Okay, but instead of saying it blends into something higher, why couldn't it be instead that I am my individual person, but right, also all the other individual people? Like, why can't you have all of these identities instead of just one?
I think there's a sense in which that does occur. We are not another person, but we have that other person. Like, we have Christ. We have them interior to us, but there remains that distinction there, because I just don't think that it logically makes sense that you could be yourself and also be another, because like these are two absolutes, right? Each individual is absolute, like image of God. And if they were to become each other, I think that would have to result in a negation of their distinctness. So I think what Orthodoxy is trying to get at is, how do we get a perfection of unity while remaining distinct? And I think that from our perspective, it just doesn't really make sense on a logical basis that you could be someone else but also be you. Like, how would you explain that philosophically? How would you justify the idea of being someone else and you?
It would blend into the henosis concept in the sense that if the hypostasis is the self with a capital S of Carl Jung, which it sounded like, then that is there causally contained in the one already. And so if you had that identification with the highest aspect of yourself, that would place you in an identity with the one, because your first being, in a sense, would be causally contained in the one already. So if you had made it there all the way, gone as close to the first principle as possible, then there would no longer be a distinction. There would be a distinction, but you wouldn't exclusively be your hypostasis, to use it in your sense, as I think you're using it.
Right.
Instead, like, you would kind of, because that's there, all that's good, all that's real in your personal identity is there already contained in the one. But once you got to that level, you wouldn't be making the discriminating identification act. You wouldn't be like saying this and not this. It would just be the simple I am containing all of the goodnesses that come from all individual things. And that would be, I mean, it makes sense with the kind of procession reversion idea in Procline theology, where you have a movement away, procession from the one that is creative, that multiplies, that creates these distinctions, and then you have a reversion of all of these things back to their source. And because there is this cycle, it's a way of baking the having already created stuff process into the abiding or fundamental nature of the higher thing. So the one processes It abides, processes, and reverts. Everything that proceeded from the one reverts to the one. Ultimately, everything real, obviously not the evil stuff. The evil is going to be kind of a matter of perspective. To God, nothing will be bad, only for particular souls. And Proclus like identifies exactly what level of soul evil first appears. And it doesn't have an ultimate reality. Only for those souls and things beneath them does evil have a reality. But in any case, the multiplicity goes back to the one and kind of in that sense like fills out the abiding nature. But because this isn't a sequence of steps, it's an eternal cycle, sort of like the Trinity is an eternal communion,
right?
There isn't this kind of problem that you mentioned earlier where mm-hmm. like, you know, why does the one have to create if in order to be good? Well, the creative act is there already, kind of baked in essentially,
right?
Anyway, because this abiding, preceding, reverting cycle is intrinsic to the one itself.
Gotcha. Okay, that helps a lot because I think like that was kind of just my goal with the talk, just to clearly define our differences here, and I think we're getting to it because for me, and from an Orthodox perspective, God is complete in himself. Like everything you were talking about with like the sort of the creative necessity, like obviously we don't say Christ or the Son and the Spirit are created, but this this movement beyond oneself that I agree is necessary for true perfection, that is already in the Trinity. And then also all the logi, all the ideas for individual beings and their natures, their essences are in God as an idea, as a thought. And then creation is genuinely something other than God. But because every created being is from God, receives its being entirely from God, so is entirely contingent and is in a certain sense has a lesser being than God in the sense that without God there would not be another, like there's the three hypostases that are necessary, and then there are other hypostases that are completely contingent, and by right. I just mean other persons, like created beings,
yeah.
And these are completely contingent, so they don't have to, like, there is no necessity that these things return to the one. Like, they're like that, and that has to do with our understanding of free will and the genuine mm-hmm. otherness outside of God. There is a, it is up to us to synergize our wills with God, because in order to have a personal communion with someone, like even just me and you, there has to be our free will involved. Like I need to consent mm-hmm. to talk with you, and then I need to actually do it. I need to participate. So we believe that in the same way that we're downstream from God in the created order, like not the created order, but in terms of him being eternal, us being created, him being necessary, us being contingent, in the same way, we receive grace from God. And that is like the primary cause of our ability, like that energy that we receive, the grace we receive, is what we use to synergize our wills. Like we couldn't do that without his will, but also you also need the synergy of the will to return back to God. And that's why mm-hmm. we believe in stuff like eternal damnation. Like eternal damnation is possible because we are truly created outside of God. He genuinely out of nothing creates something outside himself because he's perfect in himself. So it doesn't really matter, like ontologically, what happens to creation. God as a personal loving being obviously cares and draws everyone to himself, calls us all back to him. But ontologically speaking, we could all reject God and be damned, and that wouldn't have an effect on God's nature because he's complete in the Trinitarian communion. So I think mm-hmm. the difference here is that you, from a monistic perspective, you would want to show how ultimately every single thing, every distinction, which, or I guess it's illusory from the perspective of the one, but are real distinctions, like at yeah. their level of being, yeah. they ultimately need to return back to the one as their essence. And then, but for us, we would say, our essence is genuinely other than God's, is genuinely other than the one, and for that reason we have freedom and the ability to return to God or to lose ourselves.
The concept usia essence is clearly different as we're
yes,
talking about
yes
it.
For sure.
So I would say there are usias that are distinct from the one. And it's not that all things have one essence in the one.
Sure.
They have their own, like I, as an individual, have my own essence that's distinct from yours. But at the same time, there is a human nature that both of us share in, and there is the essence of human nature. So we have that essence of human nature. We also have our particular essences. So that it's a slightly different concept. But the problem here with free will has to do actually with the same ambiguity in the ultimate self-identity that I mentioned in Plato himself and in the Neoplatonists. So we clearly have our soul. Our soul is one eternal structure. The soul has its essence in eternity and its energy in time in Platonism. So like the essence of my soul is it has an eternal existence no matter what, and yet it's not the one itself. It is something, in a sense, it has a necessary role in the whole of things, but you could call it created. You could call it generated. It is in the image of the one. It's not the one itself as that essence. But as I was saying, I don't know that the self-identity is ultimately restricted to the essence of my particular soul. At one level, in Platonism, you can say there are all these hierarchical levels that necessarily must be, and yet they are kind of generated from the one, and they do have a necessary reversion. But if these are all roles in the hierarchical system that we occupy, but aren't us fundamentally, then we as individual, like the real identity that we are, could potentially move down indefinitely and lead to an eternal damnation, or move up all the way to full henosis. So it just depends on where you situate this fundamental identity. But as far as like the necessity of creation, that does, I think, amount to a real distinction. Because also one other qualification here, these roles may have like a necessary sense of generation. They may like be necessary beings, but the individual path through them may be like indefinitely multiplied. Like you might take an infinite number of paths, in the same sense that like, you know, there's one map, but you can navigate it in infinite variety of ways. So in that sense, we may be dealing with like the freedom realm, which is like kind of infinitely more vast than the necessary hierarchical structure that is defined intrinsically. But anyway, so that's, I think, where the real difference lies. It's that all of the forms, I think, are necessary, and yet they're images. All souls are necessary as a logical consequence of the forms being necessary, because what defines a particular soul is the kind of temporal way in which it shifts between the different forms. So it's sort of like, if you admit that a certain set of mathematical principles are like real, then immediately all of their consequences have to be real too. You can't say only the principles have a necessary existence, not the consequences. Once you define the principles, immediately the consequences follow. So in the same way, if the forms are necessary, then all the souls, which amount to all the kind of paths through the forms, to oversimplify it, are necessary too. And that would be the last of the necessary beings. Usias are necessary. So souls, forms, and of course everything in the first hypostasis as well would be necessary, and yet created in a sense.
Okay. Yeah, I agree. That would be like a distinction. And one thing I've been wanting to ask someone who takes a monistic view of reality is, when it comes to, like, you talk about how everything is implicitly or seminally contained within the higher orders of being, right? So, and then the one contains everything. My question would just be, like, how are you conceiving of the one? And, like, how does multiplicity, like, is there an internal multiplicity to the one, or is it like you're going to take the apophatic approach to this, like we can't even speak of it? And like, because for me, and I was kind of assuming, because I've heard that the one is like a pure, like a divine simplicity, like in a Thomistic sense. And my problem with this is that when you're understanding when you're talking about a simple thing, like absolutely simple in the sense of a perfect, almost like a perfect self-relation, from my, like, something that Orthodox theology, especially recently, especially in the past like century, has really emphasized is that self-relation is almost like a concept that's foreign to our ontology, because God isn't a self-relation. God is a Trinity. Humans aren't self-relations because we are entirely contingent upon God. So God gives us to us and gives our being to us, and then we're meant to respond to him. So like being is this dialogue, this like the fullness of existence is the communion, the dialogue with God. So there's always a self-transcendence as opposed to a self-relation. So how do you conceive multiplicity in the one? Is it something you can't even think, or, and why? Yeah, this is what I'm wondering. Why, on the basis of the one, do we have to have the other hypostases, or are you going from the lower level and then deducing the one from that? Or do you think you can go both ways, or yeah?
Well, yeah, the dialectical process would be moving from particulars up ultimately to the one, sure, and then back down. So both forms of motion are possible. But no, I don't conceive of the one in strict terms. Like, a conception of it is impossible. Right. And yet, like, we kind of circulate around these higher, you know, apophatically predicated, what's the term I'm looking for? Ineffable levels of reality. We have to kind of circumambulate them and know them by their consequence in lower levels of being. So like, if we know one of the forms, which I do think it's possible to have knowledge of, although not a concept of, we don't have a concept of each of the forms. The concept would be like the term noema. And that's at more of like a dianoetic level, which is kind of the level of soul itself, like the thought process, discursive reasoning, and relational definitions. That's it, like that soul level of what we are. But then the intellect is a more unitive mental process. I mean, it's inadequate to call it a process.
What is the intellect? What is the intellect? Because the intellect can't be reduced to like rational comprehension of concepts and thinking of concepts. Right. But what exactly is it?
It's what allows for the rational comprehension of concepts. It's I mean, they use metaphors. The Neoplatonists use metaphors to get at it. So like Proclus talks about how in doing math, there's one level at which you can generate hypotheses as axioms, so like generate axioms hypothetically, and there you're not like using intellect. But he says there's a deeper level where you intuit the necessity of these axioms. And obviously you can't use mathematical reasoning to be able to intuit the necessity of a mathematical axiom, because I mean, all mathematical processes are done on the basis of some like axiom. You can't use an algorithm to generate the basis of that algorithm. Mm-hmm. So there has to be something more direct, intuitive, and unprocedural that allows these mental processes. So that's kind of I accept that logical argument for the necessity of like a super dialogical or dialectical, what's the best word for this? Dianoetic is the best term. There's something beyond dianoetic discursive thought. There has to be, and that's where we find this notion of intellectual intuition. And the way in which you intellectually intuit a form, I mean, Plato describes metaphorically in the Phaedrus, after this basically mystical ascent of the soul through the realms of being, and until you like touch beauty itself, and he describes it as a touch, right? Like a direct contact, not like a distant apprehension. But yeah, it's, I think in the dialogues, like that's kind of what Plato is leading us to, is the, like, we question the nature of justice over 10 books in the Republic. You know, we take forever to try to circle around this notion and see all the problems with every particular discursive definition we arrive at. Any like taxonomic definition ends up being slightly inadequate. And the, I mean, after the process is what's meant to like trigger this intellectual intuition in us of the essence of this thing. So that's how we would know the forms. So it's very, it's an indirect process, but we do have intellectual access to them. And then beyond that, we can infer, given what we know intellectually of the forms, we can infer what right. their paradigms must be like,
right.
because obviously they're made in the image of the one and everything above that. So so anyway, the multiplicity in the one can't be a numerical multiplicity, because numerical multiplicity comes beneath the intellectual realm. It's inherent to the realm of soul, basically. It's in the mathematicals. It has to be beyond the number of the forms. But Iamblichus calls like being itself the chief among the second hypostasis, the kind of ousia, first among the forms. He defines that as number itself, but a super mathematical number. So it like, because we can talk about a number of the forms, but it's not like there's the first form, second form, third form.
Right.
There's some kind of multiplicity, but it's beyond what we can deal with dianoetically. And then it, beyond that, there is like a multitude and a limiting aspect in the henads. And then beyond that, there's the monad, principle of limitation, and indefinite dyad, principle of energy and multiplication. And obviously beyond that, there is the seed of both of those in the one. And so that's the sense in which there is a unity and a multiplicity, but it's a multiplicity and a unity both that are totally beyond, certainly beyond any definition that we could rationally come to. It's beyond sure. even intellectual. It's yeah, something that has to be very loosely inferred.
Sure. Okay, well, I have one more question. And it's about what you're talking about with the forms and like the intellectual knowledge of the forms. I was just wondering, like, is there any way you could, like using what you know from Plato and your own personal philosophy, is there any way you could describe this even by analogy to the way the way we would have an intellectual knowledge of the forms? Because for us, we can't, there's like, and I'm glad you clarified this, because I think a lot of times Orthodox people critique the Platonic view of the intellect and thinking that we're using the intellect in the same way that someone like the Scholastics did, that you guys are using it in the same way, that the intellect is just like the ability to think about concepts and like be a rational mm-hmm. being. But yeah. There's clearly something above that. And there are parallels there with Orthodoxy, because with Orthodoxy, we have, the nous, the heart, the heart is like the spiritual center of a person.
And nous, I think, is the Greek term that intellect is translated from.
Oh, okay. Wow. Yeah. So there has to be an influence there. And I think nous came up later in Orthodox theology. So like, we probably took it from Platonism. Like we're probably inspired by that. I may be wrong there, but, that makes most sense. So the nous is like different from the intellect, like the way we would use intellect is like rational knowledge, rationality.
That's dianoia.
Okay, sure. And so yeah, so there's parallel concepts here. And then the nous is where we encounter God, and we make this spiritual ascent in the heart, because the heart is the center of the person. It's like, it's almost like who you are, because your knowledge, like your rational thinking, that is not you. Like you are thinking it, but who you are as a person isn't located in your intellect. It's located in the heart. So the reason why the heart is the spiritual center of the person, how we move towards God, why like there's this notion of like retreating into the depths of your heart, moving away from the distractions of the fallen world and the world in time, is because here at the center of our personhood is where we can have a personal encounter with God. So even though we can't describe it using like we can't circumscribe what it's like what the immediacy of a relationship, a personal relationship with God is, conceptually the way you can kind of think about it is like a personal relationship with another person. It has to do with this irreducible, like like it's irreducible because like you are the one doing it. It has it, it's you do, so you couldn't step outside of yourself and make some abstraction and be like, oh, this is what was occurring, like and fully circumscribe it, because it's like you doing it. So you meet God, you meet God like heart to heart, person to person. This is how you have the experience of God. So what that would be the way we would describe it. And I think it does make sense within the system. So, but how would you, like, even if it kind of is based on like ambiguous terms for you, like, what would the, how would you describe the intellect's apprehension of the forms? Like how, like, is there any analogy you could make with like rational knowledge, for example, or any, or perception even? Because for us, it's like, we see God, like there's this, like, there's like an analogy between actually seeing like the rays of the sun and then actually seeing God through the personal encounter with him. Like that's an analogy. Is there any similar analogies for the Platonic view of seeing the forms, knowing the forms?
Well, yeah, I mean, and literally it's the sun too in the Republic.
Right. Yeah, it's a cave. Yeah.
But yeah, no, the term nous is what we're using for intellect, and that is the summit of our soul, and that is where we make contact with, you know, the realm of forms itself. Most Neoplatonists take an even more indirect relationship with the forms, in the sense that, like, they wouldn't even use the language, ironically, that Plato uses of actually making contact with the forms themselves. I kind of think you can make contact with the forms themselves, but most Neoplatonists say we have the koinai enoiai in our mind, which are images of the forms.
Yeah. So, just interrupt. Yeah. I totally forgot my, like, the question I wanted to ask you is how, like, I think it makes sense that you could, what's the term you use? Like, make contact with a personal God, right? Like, person to person. I don't see how you could make contact with the forms. Like, how does that occur?
Well, because they are there in the hyparxis of your personal intellect. But that's kind of getting at this distinction that I was just saying. Like, Proclus seems to say that we have the koinai enoiai, the images of the forms, in our mind, and we can know those more perfectly by dialectical methods and all of that. And that's what we're doing in, like, the whole process of philosophy is trying to, like, clarify those in a sense. And yet, like, he seems to indicate more of this kind of mystical union with higher realities in any case. I think it's maybe because Proclus, like, emphasized the gods more than, like, the importance of making contact with the forms themselves, probably just to, like, emphasize, like, this isn't a solely intellectual thing. There is that higher unific henatic realm that we really ought to be aiming at, I suppose. But in any case, like, the summit of our intellect converges with the second hypostasis itself, converges with the realm of forms themselves. So if you ascend to your summit simultaneously, you are, like, passing through the realm of forms. And if you continued even further, of course, in my opinion, as more of a non-dualist, you would eventually get back to the one.
Cool. Yeah, thank you. That is all the questions I have for you. I really like this conversation because I think we did a good job of, like, explaining the differences and the similarities, because I was surprised by the amount of similarities that we had there. I think, like, oh, I guess one last question for you is, do you think your interpretation of Plato is sort of the orthodox view? Because I know with, like, I kind of come from a Hegelian background, and literally every single other Hegelian you meet has another perspective on Hegel, like, spirit man differs from Zizek, and then Zizek differs from another guy, and, like, there's so many different interpretations. So do you think with Plato it's, like, pretty cut and dry what he believes, or do you are you, like, just following the traditional, or
no yeah,
well, do you think that you are interpreting Plato more faithfully than, like, or as faithfully as you, like, do you think, like, you have any differences with Plato himself, or do you think you're actually just faithfully following his teachings?
Well, I don't actually necessarily conform 100% to what I think Plato thought. I also don't claim to fully understand what Plato thought. Sure. Plato makes arguments against a many worlds cosmology, and I accept a many worlds cosmology. Now, is that some kind of noble lie that it's better for us to believe in simply one world? It's hard to tell. There are a small number of kind of doctrinal differences that I would have with what I think Plato is saying. But as far as like interpreting Plato, I try to follow Proclus more than anyone else. Among Neoplatonists, I think Proclus is the closest to the truth. And that's based on his writing style. It's based on the clarity of his arguments. Later writers like Damascius tries to kind of go beyond Proclus in various ways, but he also has a very temperamental style of writing. Kind of reminds me of like Nietzsche, the way he writes sometimes, where he starts like complaining about personalities and it's like, this doesn't look like a real philosophical disposition. And Proclus gives like comprehensive textual arguments from Plato himself, why that the interpretation he gives, it should be considered authentic. So I think Proclus is the greatest interpreter of Plato throughout all history. In terms of like the modern schools of Platonism, like there's the Tübingen school, which is relatively mainstream, which is basically like Neoplatonists were right. And when I read most of the translators of these Neoplatonic works, they all tend to agree with the idea that like Proclus basically defines Neoplatonism. He was the most authoritative voice, and everyone else is kind of either pre-Procline and like hasn't fully systematized it yet, or they like basically conform to his views. So that's kind of my school of thought on it. I wouldn't defer, I wouldn't differ from Proclus on interpretation of Plato himself, just out of like humility. At this point in time, I still haven't finished all of Proclus's writing because he's extremely voluminous and dense and difficult. Right. And so I don't know. I think, basically I'm not going to disagree with whatever Proclus says at this point.
Fair enough. Okay, well, so that was a great conversation. Thank you for coming on. Anything you want to just tell people about? I know, for example, the Understanding Plato channel. I'll put a link to that in the description. That's a great channel. So for anyone who wants to learn about Plato and learn like the basics of Plato, and then I know even in your reading groups, they're still open to anyone who wants to join, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if you want to get even deeper into the text with Eric and with other people, there's the reading group. And is that pretty much all you're doing, the reading group and the Understanding Plato channel?
Yeah, I mean, I have my main channel still. Yeah, and I just post whatever I want to say on there.
Like, why to join a cult?
Oh, yeah, that was my last video. I thought it was a good title. I mean, if you think about it, isn't the cult kind of the traditional lifestyle as far as like going back in history?
That's
just the way it's always been. So you can't be a traditionalist unless you're pro cult. That's my perspective.
Sure.
I have a few different reading groups. So we do the Platonic Dialogues, we do the Neoplatonists, in another one we do Aristotle's Organon. At the moment we're finishing up Prior Analytics, thank God, because that is the most miserable text I've ever read in my life. And then we have another group on Galileo, actually, so it's not like exclusively Platonism, but it's kind of in that line. And more like early modern philosophers were influenced by Platonism and Aristotelianism than we tend to think. And also there's more like unity between Plato and Aristotle than many people suspect. But so it's kind of a broad, like looking at intellectual history through the lens of Platonism, really. But that's what we got going on.
Cool. Okay. Well, thanks for coming on again. And to anyone watching, subscribe to Airvol and Understanding Plato, and join the Telos Bound Discord, because if you want to join a cult, no, I'm kidding, but we got some great conversation. I was gonna say we have a voice chat tonight, but this isn't going up until Wednesday, but we do voice chats and stuff, so join us there. But Eric, thank you.
Thank you, Trey. It was fun.